give you lots of time to prepare for Halloween a couple of weeks before. And but then before just coming in here to the sit, one of the Sangha members asked me, or was concerned about, maybe we could address the kind of the state of the country right now, the war and terrorism. And this is the first time that I've sat here in the Dharma seat with you all since America started war in Afghanistan. So it might be quite appropriate to give a talk on demons for both purposes. But I'm a little bit unsure, given America seems to go to war regularly. Mm-hmm. But this particular war has entered the psyche of our country in a much deeper way than any that I've been aware of since I've been paying attention. And also I'm very aware that it isn't simply war and terrorism and the threat of that, but there's a lot of anxiety about, in general. There are people who have lost their work, people who are possibly going to lose their work soon, and difficulty finding work. And there's a lot of uncertainty and anxiety, and people have lost a lot of money in the stock market. And someone I talked to today and didn't have very much money, but had put it into an IRA account, and half of it's gone, and needs now the money for medical purposes. And so just aware of all this anxiety. So I'm not sure. Should we do, should I just venture forth on demons? Or is there a need for our community to somehow just hold the evening in an open way and address how we are? Part of what mindfulness is, kind of central premise of mindfulness, is to start always where we are and how we're actually feeling and experiencing and perceiving the world and ourselves, and let everything else kind of evolve from starting where you are. And if I start with demons, it might or might not be where you are. And given how things are, what should we do this evening? It's difficult to ask a group like this, but is there some sense we can try to get from the group? What would you like this evening? A show of hands. So how many people want demons?
The choices.
So the choices. So one choice is to talk about the hungry ghosts and demons. And the other choice is to talk about hungry goats and demons. The first one is hungry ghosts and demons, and the second one is just to be open, kind of more maybe almost Quaker style, and see what needs to be discussed here as a group, what we need to be mindful of as a given the state of our society and country. And so how many people would like to have demons and hungry ghosts? And how many people would like to have the state of our anxiety in our country and what's going on? So it's not quite even, but I certainly heard the voices of the people who are concerned about the state of the way things are. And what I'll try to do is to, I think, you know, demons and hungry ghosts applies to both. So we'll see how I can tie it together here. So this was meant to be a kind of preparation for Halloween. And Halloween is, in I guess Old English or something, means the evening before All Saints Day. And All Saints Day being this wonderful day of this purity of the saints. And then the evening before is a time for the ghosts, the goblins, the demons to come out. And there's quite a contrast between the light and the dark, between the pure and maybe the dangerous. And some of us now have forgotten or we don't think about, or we don't celebrate as a country, the original day, which is All Saints' Day. We don't, as a country, often celebrate the great possibility of purity in ourselves, the possibility of compassion, the possibility of spiritual excellence, spiritual attainment, spiritual transformation. There aren't that many spiritual leaders that attain superhero status in our country. We do spend a lot of time now in October focusing on Halloween, which is the evening before, where it's ghosts and goblins. But what's happened a lot, I think, is that the ghosts and goblins have been, the demons have been, certainly they've been commercialized for us. I was in Walgreens today. Rack and racks, lots of racks of ghosts and witches and horrible creatures to be bought. And also they've been kind of Disneyfied, kind of some certain level at which monsters and ghosts and demons have been sanitized for us and made cute sometimes. And demons are terrifying. That's what, you know, ghosts are often terrifying, but certainly demons are. You wouldn't want to meet one in real life unless you had a lot of skill. And so we don't look so much at the spiritual side of the holiday, and the demonic side of the holiday gets sanitized for us. So what is it to face our demons? Part of it, I think, has been sanitized because we don't want to face our demons. Some of us don't want to accept the fact that they're there. And it takes sometimes a major crisis, like a country like we have now, where people realize that under the surface of their life, which is relatively comfortable perhaps, or going along the way, whatever it is going, that as it gets disturbed or threatened or challenged, underneath there's wellsprings of fear, wellsprings of anxiety and attachments and potential for rage and anger. And unless we somehow face the demons within us in a way where it's wise to do so, and which leads to a new relationship to them and leads to wisdom and transformation, unless we do it at times when we think they're relatively safe, then in times of crisis we won't be prepared. And then it's all too easy then to act out of our fear, to act out of our anger. And fear and anger often have a centrifugal force that spins us away from ourselves, away from what's actually going on, and often spinning us off into our abstract ideas about what's going on, stories we make about what's going on. And many of our stories are not accurate. And sometimes we end up demonizing the other. War is famous. It's well known that in situations of war, each side will demonize the other side. And the language of evil is being used these days. And we use the language, America, George Bush uses the word language of evil about the terrorists and what's going on elsewhere in the world. And we use the language, and they use the language of evil towards us. Many people here in America use the name of God as on our side. They use the language of God as on their side. It's really striking, I feel, how the similar kind of language, similar kind of understanding, similar perspective is being used for diametrically opposed views in a conflict where two people are at war with each other. And part of that process is to demonize the other, just to not see the other human person as a human being. And this happens again over and over again. Explicitly, it's been we see people as animals. There are situations where your opponent is seen as being less than animals. And Buddhists have done that down through the ages when Buddhists have been in war. So when I was in Jerusalem, I went into the tourist office to ask about maybe going visiting the refugee camps. And the woman looked at me in horror and said, "Why do you want to go visit those animals, those dogs?" I was shocked. This is a government tourist agency. And we do it here in this country towards people elsewhere in the world right now. It's a very dangerous tendency to demonize someone else. I'm very struck by the kind of analysis that Carl Jung and people like him make, that when we divide the world into good and bad and good and evil, and have evil out there, it represents often a division in our own minds between good and evil, parts of our own minds we're not willing to look at. One of the people who perhaps has some authority besides Carl Jung, I don't know what authority he has to say this, but is Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who saw evil in first-hand ways in the prisons of Siberia. If only it were so simple. If only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the hearts of every human being. And who is willing to destroy a piece of his or her own heart? So these words I'm saying are not meant to be a political view or statement about what should be done or how to understand the complexity of the current state of affairs. But they are meant to be encouragement to use the mindfulness as a mirror to turn the mind back at ourselves and try to understand when centrifugal forces away from ourselves are operating, when fear and anger and hate, confusion, anxiety get us spinning out in our thoughts and our ideas, and we start acting maybe irrationally or we start letting the demons kind of take over. One of the things that happens is as we stop paying attention to where the beginning is, we start paying attention to where we actually are and let the mind carry itself out into abstractions, and is that it gives a chance for the unresolved forces within us to start functioning unconsciously. The unresolved fear and anger that we might be carrying within us, then it's like a crack opens up in the mind because we're not paying attention, and it kind of spills out, and then it's all too easy for us to lash out more and more. I saw this in myself today. I was kind of shocked. So you'll be shocked by me now. So I was driving through San Francisco on the freeway, and the kind of hospital curve area there, kind of near San Francisco General Hospital, and I don't know what the speed limit is there, but maybe it's probably 50 miles an hour. It can't be more than that. And I was going 50 miles an hour, but in the fast lane. So this is a confession. Someone will absolve me, maybe. And so you know, that's what that was the background for this. And so then one motorcycle passed me by, kind of snuck in between me and the lane next to me, kind of between me and the car next to me. And as he sped by me, he did something with his finger. So that was fine. And then I realized that probably I was irritating people, and maybe first chance I got, maybe I should move over to a different lane. Before I could do that, another motorcycle did the same thing. But this motorcycle, in my view, was dangerously close to my bumper. And I thought for sure, I thought for a moment he certainly was going to hit my bumper because there wasn't hardly any space between me and the car next to me. But he got by, and then he did the same thing with his finger. So if that was fine, so, you know, as soon as I could, I got over to the next lane, let traffic get by. And then I reflected for a moment about it, and what I noticed that this fantasy popped up in my mind. And this is what shocked me. The fantasy was kind of, I felt, it wasn't just fun, I felt a little bit irritated by this. And I was a little bit kind of driving on the freeway, which kind of sometimes puts me in a little bit, you know, mood. I don't know quite how to describe it. I'm not as attentively mindful and settled and calm as I could be in my life. And I noticed this fantasy popped up was about, oh, maybe I could have just kind of, you know, leaned a little bit in to the right and bumped him. You know, I would never want to do that. But it's tragic to do that. But I was surprised that this awful thought kind of popped up. But the reflection I had immediately afterwards was that how easy it was for that thought to pop up, given the state that I was in, the irritation I was in, the little bit kind of being kind of a little bit frazzled for driving on the freeway a lot today. And I reflected how easy it is for people to commit things they wouldn't want to do otherwise when we're fueled by fear or anxiety or anger, or we're kind of caught up in those. And it's very easy suddenly to lash out. I think that if those people going by, for example, had known a little bit about my condition and what I've been doing today and the state of my mind and why I was driving in that lane, and, you know, actually kind of saw me for who I was and what was going on with me, it wouldn't have occurred to them to have done what they did with their finger. But they were also, you know, they were operating. It's very easy, but it's very easy to do those kinds of things when we're not settled on ourselves. The demons creep in very quickly if we turn off the light. I brought this up a few times now in recent talks, only partly because a friend of mine who's a Buddhist practitioner in different Buddhist groups keeps bringing it up to me. And she keeps complaining about there's no room for un-Buddhist thoughts in the Buddhist groups. If you go with these Buddhist community sitting groups, you're not supposed to have un-Buddhist thoughts. And you know, something, people then censor themselves. You know, oh, you can't feel that way. You know, people are furious that, you know, some people, you know, have this tremendous rage inside of themselves. And, you know, if Osama bin Laden walked in now, I mean, they would pounce or whatever. You know, some people have this tremendous rage, and some people have tremendous, you know, fear or whatever. And it's not cool. You know, Buddhists are supposed to be, you know, full of loving kindness and compassion and wisdom and understanding. And so that side of who we are then, you know, feels like it's not permitted or allowed, or it's too inappropriate to share that in a Buddhist community because it's un-Buddhist. And it is un-Buddhist. In that Buddhism tries to live from compassion and kindness and generosity and these kinds of feelings, and not to be caught by the reactivities of our mind. But it's un-Buddhist to censor it. It's even more un-Buddhist to censor it. The Buddhist thing is to hold it in the light of awareness, to see it for what it is clearly. And if we can't honestly and fully admit who we are and what's going on with us, then there can't be any Buddhist practice. So this is a place for un-Buddhist thoughts. If this is not the place for it, I don't know where it should be. So I told you about my little fantasy. It popped up and for me today. So hungry ghosts. Say your family, or you at your home, you get a puppy. And it's very nice and loving, lovable puppy, and you name it a nice name, Lassie, I guess. And the embodiment of all good. And then the dog starts growing up, and after a while, the dog gets a little bit bigger than you kind of care for, a little more rambunctious, and and kind of knocks into things in the furniture. And every once in a while, you kind of say, sit down and be quiet and don't be so rambunctious. And it even shows its teeth to you a little bit, some snarls a little bit. But sometimes it makes a mess on the floor. And this dog becomes so irritating, It's a rambunctious dog who doesn't know quite how to control his bowel movements. So you take Lassie and you say, well, this is too much for me. And you put him in the basement. And you keep him in the basement. And just forget about him, because you don't want to deal with this problem anymore. And there's all these rats down there for the Lassie to live on, so... So Lassie goes pretty well down there, but the dog kind of periodically howls and screams because it's angry and afraid and upset and being down there in the basement in the dark. And so you and your family decide that this is kind of unacceptable or it's too difficult or too painful, and so you move to the second floor of your house because you don't want to deal with this. And you live there. You live in the second floor for a long time. You even build stairs that go out the second floor window down, so you don't have to go into the first floor at all. And you live there quite nicely for a long time. And after some time, you realize, wait a minute, didn't we have a dog once upon a time? Wasn't there a dog, Lassie? Wasn't there a dog? Oh yeah, there was this dog. We should maybe go check on it. So you go and you open the door to the basement, and there's this vicious, snarling, yapping, kind of biting, ferocious beast that's kind of, there. And then you shut the door and move to the third floor. Or you get your gun, to shoot the dog or hit it or do something. You kind of hit it and submit to back into submission. And what the dog mostly needs at this point is it needs a lot of patience. I don't know what a dog like that needs. Maybe different dogs need different kinds of things. Some of them need a lot of love and a lot of patience, a lot of space. Some of them need to be kind of reintroduced to humankind slowly. Maybe it means you have to open the door one day and throw some nice food down there for a change, or provide some light in there, and slowly you kind of get the person used to your kindness, and you show that you're not going to harm them. There's all kinds of ways. Or perhaps you put on one of these great, dog armors they have on the arms, where the dogs can bite. And so you go, in one hand you have some wonderful food for the dog, and the other hand you have this big thing. And so when the dog jumps to bite, you kind of let it bite because you're safe. And then the dog kind of tires that for a while and relaxes. And slowly you find some way a way. But it takes it would take a long time. If you lock the dog into the basement further, the dog would just get worse. And you don't want the dog to die, because if the dog dies in your basement, even the attic's not going to work. And sometimes you just don't want to let it out, into the living room right away. You need this preparation, this time of preparation. So sometimes it's like that in ourselves. That there's some part of ourselves which we disown, that we don't want to look at, that we don't want to accept. Spiritual people do this a lot, unfortunately, because spiritual people have a high standard, often, of what is, the right way of living, the right values, the right emotions, the right intentions, the right something. And whenever you have some part of yourself that you consider really the right thing or the right way to be, then that which you consider unacceptable gets somehow delegated away in the basement to unawareness, not paying attention to, not accepting. It's like me, where I had a self-image many years ago of someone who doesn't have any anger. And so I couldn't see my anger. I had it, but it wasn't visible to me, my friends would say. It's obvious. And You know, and each of us is a mixed bag. Each of us, you know, many different intentions, forces operate within an individual person. And if we tend to select one side over the other, this is the part I'm going to pay attention to, this other side I'm not going to pay attention to or deal with, we end up creating a dog in the basement. We split ourselves off. If we act on our judgments, if we judge the world good and bad, and a lot of the more dramatic ways in which we judge other people is often a way in which we are separating ourselves from ourselves. It's kind of a judging of ourselves. I've known people who are plagued by judgments. And as they get into it, just study that mindfully, what's really going on when they judge? And they find out that they're protecting themselves from themselves. If they judge other people, then they don't have to look honestly at themselves, because you're always kind of, you know, attacking outwards. For some people, that's the way it works. So there are ways in which we separate ourselves from ourselves. The process of mindfulness is to open all the doors in the house. The doors to the attic, the doors to the chapel, if you have a chapel in your house, the doors to the basement. There's no practice of mindfulness without opening doors. So it means we have to find some way to meet the dogs or meet the demons. So in Buddhist cosmology, there is a category of being called hungry ghosts. There's a category of being called, sometimes called in English, the titans, the asuras, sometimes called the jealous gods. And there's a category of being called animals, and there's a category of beings that live in hell, and there's a category of beings called the gods. And then there's a category of beings called human beings. These are the six realms in Buddhist cosmology where people get reborn in. You can get reborn in hell, which is a place of great suffering. You can get reborn as an animal, which is a place of great confusion. And animals tend to act on their instincts. If they're hungry, they want to eat. If they're cold, they want to get warm. If they're attacked, they want to lash out or run away. Confusion and instinct. There's the hungry ghosts, which are characterized by greed. And if you have too much greed in this lifetime, guess where you're going to go? And hungry ghosts are these beings who have these huge, 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 huge bellies. And these huge, huge mouths. And these huge, huge, insatiable appetites. And very, 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 very thin throats. So they can never get enough food down their throat to satisfy the hunger. So they're always going for more, trying, wanting more. Nothing's enough. Nothing's ever enough. Nothing is enough as a hungry ghost. Sometimes parents are like that. I've been told... I'll find out for myself soon enough, I guess, but that once children grow up, some people are still living through their children. They can't get enough of them. Don't let go of them. Some people can't get enough job promotions and just can't get enough. Some people can't get enough money. No way. I met someone once who described himself as a psychoeconomist. And his job, he was a psychologist, who he worked with people who were very wealthy. His specialty was working with people who were very, very wealthy, who didn't feel that they had enough money yet. So he had this one client who had $60 million, and was concerned about not having enough money. Anxious enough to want to go to a therapist about it. So it's a kind of a hungry ghost syndrome. And then there's the Titans, the jealous gods. And they're the ones that also have desire. They have a desire for power, and they have a desire for the goodness of others. Because what they're jealous of is the gods. So they're always warring against the gods, trying to get the upper hand on the gods, kind of dominate the god realm and take it over and get all the goods in the god realms. And then there's the god realm, which the god realm is there's infinite pleasure, a lot of joy and pleasure and delight and just all good, except when the titans come to fight. And if you're lucky, there's all these realms of heavenly worlds. There's the kind of hierarchy of them is 33, going up further and further up. And the higher up you go, the greater the bliss and the joy and the rapture. Now, it's said that in all these realms, except the human realm, that there is no practice, no spiritual practice. If you have too much pleasure and joy, then you're not going to pay attention. You're not going to want to practice. You're distracted. You're content with what you have. So I've been told that by Buddhist teachers who teach in Hawaii, that it's a little bit hard to get people, residents in Hawaii, that interested in regular, ongoing practice. Like they do offer one-day sittings in Hawaii. People don't come that often. And that what the teachers say is that because they might suffer in Hawaii, but you go to the beach. You know, why practice? You go to the beach. And if you're in the hell realm, it's also very hard to practice, impossible to practice, because the suffering is so distracting that there's no motivation to practice, no understanding of where to go or what to do. And in the animal realm also, there's too much confusion. In the hungry ghost realm also, there's too much this unfulfilled desire that kind of blinds us to the possibility of practice. It's only in the human realm that practice can occur. And the human realm is the realm where awareness resides. We can really pay attention to what's going on. In a sense, the other realms, we can't really pay enough attention. Now, one way of understanding this cosmology is that these six realms is something that we go through in the course of one day. And we're constantly cycling through these. And there are times we fall into hell, and times we fall into being a hungry ghost, and whatever. But what we want to do is become more and more human, which means developing our mindfulness and awareness. We want to do it in a way that doesn't create more dogs in the basement. We want to do it in a way that sees the demons, sees the ghosts, sees the whatever these inner forces might be, and sees them in ways that are useful and transformative. And I feel at this time in our country, it's really imperative for us to really look at these demons and hungry ghosts directly and understand some of the principles of how to work with them. So the first of all is to have the willingness to recognize them and look at them. And the willingness to be honest about it. And that's one of the possibilities for what Halloween parties are about. They can be just fun, but they can also be a time to really look and try to spend the time reflecting, what's really my demons and ghosts? What is in my basement? And then to allow it in some creative way to come out into the light. So the first is a willingness to look at it and feeling it's useful and important to do that. And then there's a series of skills a person can develop about how to deal with these demons. The stronger the demons, the stronger the medicine. One of the possibilities that some people call upon is to call upon the opposite. Sometimes that's really wise, and sometimes it tends to create more basements. It tends to be very, very careful that calling on the opposite doesn't create a sharp division that, you know, pushes away. But sometimes the opposite helps melt away the demon. So, for example, one friend of mine who was a down-and-out drug addict, living up in streets of Haight-Ashbury district in the 70s. Really felt it was the end. Felt no way out, felt a spiral downwards as some of his friends had died. And he came across a picture of, I think it was Ramana Maharshi. And he saw this picture of this Indian guru. And there was something about the purity of this guru's face, or something about something that's shown out from there, that transformed him in the moment, where he kind of was able to let go of the path he was on, and then started, for him, he started his Zen practice. There was something that pulled him out by the opposite. In the Mahayana Buddhist pantheon of bodhisattvas, all the bodhisattvas, all these celestial savior-type beings, are lay people. In the paintings, they're decked out with jewelry and beautiful hairdos and fancy clothes, except for one. And one bodhisattva is a monastic, Jizo Bodhisattva, Kitishigarbo. And Jizo Bodhisattva is the one bodhisattva who helps people who are in desperate straits. And because people who are really down and out and really desperate sometimes need to have a very strong reference of purity, of saintliness, to hold on to be able to pull themselves out. That's what's needed for some people. Sometimes the opposite is what's needed. Other times, what's needed, what some people need to do, is to call on some power that's larger than themselves. For people who come from theistic religions, that's pretty close at hand. They call upon God, for example. For kind of non-theistic religions like Buddhism, it's not so obvious then what might be the power that's larger than yourself. There isn't this obvious kind of anthropomorphic, whatever. Anyway, this being in our own image, kind of, we can relate to. But the Dharma, the practice, the Buddhas can have a sense for some people of being a force, a sense that's larger than themselves, that they can trust and rely on, that can carry them. Sometimes a Buddhist community like this is a force which is larger than an individual. And I've known people who have come to communities like this because they want to have some refuge and some support and strength from other people who are trying to be mindful and compassionate and present and living something of a life which is not caught by their addictions. The third way is the practice of insight, the practice of mindfulness. And there's a number of aspects to that. One aspect is learning how to stop and see these things clearly. And it takes a lot of skill to be able to see clearly what goes on inside of us. It's not an easy thing to do because we tend to react so quickly. We tend to judge all too quickly what's there. And what we're trying to find is this non-judgmental awareness that sees it for what it is. What happens when we react, we tend to feed the dogs. We tend to strengthen these inner forces. The famous story of the yaksha, I've maybe told it too many times, of the little little runt of an ugly dwarf, little runt of an ugly troll, who, when sat on the great Brahma's throne, Brahma being the supreme god of the Indian pantheon. And the other minor gods got all angry. And the more angry they got and yelled at him, the bigger this runt of a troll got, the more beautiful he got. It grew and grew in strength and beauty. And then finally Brahma comes along and sees what's happening. And he says, "Oh, this troll is an anger-feeding troll. And the more angry you get, the bigger it gets. What you have to do is to stop feeding it with anger, and it'll disappear." So Brahma goes up to his throne and bows and says, "It's good to see you. I hope you're doing well, and you know, I offer you my respect." And the troll shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and finally disappears. So we have to be very careful with how we react. Sometimes our reactions are so powerful, our fears and our judgments and the meaning we assign to it, that maybe we need help. Maybe we need to find other people to can hold our hand, so we hold our hand so we can go in, do that mindful exercise to get with someone else. It can be very hard to do it alone. Sometimes we need to develop separately our strength of compassion, a strength of mindfulness, strength of forgiveness, strength of acceptance, so that later we can try to open up the door to the basement and try to meet these things in a nicer way. So an important part of mindfulness is learning to see it, see these things. And if we could do that fully, for the most part, the demons, the ghosts, will be quite satisfied. And things will get better much quicker, much better. But sometimes these demons and sometimes these hungry ghosts are not best met by mindfulness only. But sometimes you need to feed them. Sometimes you need to give them something. Sometimes what required is we have to give them ourselves. Sometimes if they're disowned parts of ourselves, we have to find some way to integrate these parts into who we are. Some of the demons within us are not just angry, snapping dogs. Sometimes there's great angels of light, or great beauty, or great capacity for kindness and love that is disowned and we're afraid of. And so we have to find some way to feed that, to connect to it, to offer ourselves to this, to not be afraid of it. To not just simply sit there and look at it, but to somehow find what does it really want? What does this force within me really need? What would it take to feed it, to give it space, to give it room, to give it some time in the light? There are times where it's useful to give yourself over to the forces, these dark forces or light forces which are put in the dark, to give ourselves over to them, to find some place where it's really safe, to let them take over, to give up control. Because sometimes it's the force of control which makes it difficult. Now, this is sometimes very difficult to do and very dangerous to do. And so it needs to be done sometimes in a very, very safe and nurturing environment. Some people find that the retreat environment is such a place where this tremendous safety is often created on retreat. And it's one of the safest places that I know where a person can really go deep down into the basement and discover what's there and do what has to be done as you face the dogs there. Sometimes it's in therapy we go, and therapists can offer a tremendous amount of help in creating that safety. Sometimes it's Halloween. Because in our culture, it's not often considered very, you know, not only is it un-Buddhist to do certain thoughts or ways of being, but it's un-American or whatever, certain ways. But Halloween's a time where we can feed, we can integrate, we can become some of these things that we're afraid to look at in other times. And sometimes it's a little bit of a safe time for some people. We go to a party, we dress up as a hungry ghost, and you get to show people, this is part of who I am, and this is how I act when I'm at home in front of the refrigerator. Or maybe, you know, what you're most afraid of, petrified of, is your own compassion. Because if you opened up to your sense of compassion, then you'd have to in some way let other people into your life. And that's the most frightening thing in the world. So you go to a Halloween party dressed as Mother Teresa. And play it out a little bit. Or you go someplace. Maybe where there's more at stake. Maybe not quite as safe as a Halloween party. But to find some way to kind of recognize these forces and play with them, and it can be playful, it can be very serious, but somehow take these really seriously. Without that serious work, I don't think there is any deep spiritual transformation. if we don't learn how to open all the doors, the spiritual path is incomplete. If we don't learn to look at what fuels the centrifugal force out into reactivity, then the best parts of us won't have a chance to meet and respond to the world. And the world really needs people right now who can respond with a lot of clarity and wisdom and compassion. So may each of you face your demons so that you can see clearly this world that we live in. Thank you.